Hello, aliens, ghosts, and robots. It's Keith, and welcome back to An Invisible Sun. How are ya? How have things been? Drop me a line, if you want. Email me at wkeithtims@gmail.com, or come to the Discord server. You can find all that information at invisiblesunpod.com. I have a favor to ask of you today. One of the hardest things about being an independent author and creator is getting people to hear your work. So I'm wondering if I could count on you to help me out a little bit here. If you're enjoying the work that I do, would you please shout it out on your social media? Would you please share it with people you think might like it? Would you tell the people in your life about it? The more people that hear from you, the more likely people are to come join you in enjoying the stories. So if you don't mind, take a minute and let people know where to find me. I really do appreciate it. Okay, here's today's episode. An Invisible Sun by W. Keith Timms. Chapter 5. The door of the taxi slid closed. I was the only person inside the whole vehicle. The front windshield is both window and video screen, with a map, advertisements, and the current fare overlaid on the road before me. A soft chime punctuated the words, "Please state your destination," that appeared on the window. I dug the piece of paper from my pocket and read it aloud.
Barrows Block, down level 9, 2169 Thessalonica.
A warning tone followed. Then part of the window flickered and was replaced by the image of the taxi's overseer, a bald, droopy-eyed man with severe eyebrows, transmitting from some dingy office in the city somewhere.
"We don't go to underground, though we get you close."
His image faded out, replaced with a weather and air quality report. I didn't try to argue the point, merely sank back into the seat and let the car drive. At least I was out of the sun. The air quality was better than yesterday, but the UV index was way up. I had gotten the address from university records. I knew this was a bad idea, visiting Ken Zinn's mother unannounced. I had called twice, though never got an answer. But what could I say over the phone, anyway? I had so many questions, and half of them I couldn't even put into words. I needed to speak with her, and in person. The taxi moved smoothly through the traffic, the auto cars silently communicating to each other with vectors, velocities, proximities. It wasn't too long until I was merging onto the southbound freeway, 22 lanes stretching like a concrete river through the metal forest of Atlanta. Keep heading south, and eventually this unbroken highway would terminate in Miami. Turn around and go north, and in time you'll reach Boston. I went to a conference in Boston once, a long time ago. I was impressed by how the city had dealt with the rising water over the years, recreating much of the historic district onto floating platforms. It's too bad they couldn't save Cape Cod, though. From the photos I'd seen, it had been a beautiful place. The road became a blur of buildings and advertisements. I rubbed my sore shoulder. The shooting was 3 days ago, and the wound had closed. But even with the sleep I'd managed, thanks to the pain pills, I was still tired. And still couldn't shake the image of Ken Zinn staring at me, tears in his eyes. I never called a doctor. Too many doubts, too many questions and suspicions. Answers first, if they even come. A sudden deceleration marked the taxi's exit from the freeway into a vista of unremarkable industrial buildings, none more than a few stories tall. Pitted bridges and overpasses linked the bare streets. Chain-link fences topped with razor wire surround large concrete lots. There's not a tree, shrub, or tuft of wayward grass anywhere. I must be near the gate port. Tall buildings pose a flight hazard, and so all construction goes down, underground, instead of up. And then, like a dream or vision, the gate port appeared from behind a parking deck. Even in the daylight, it seemed to glow, surrounded by a shimmer of heat. The silver and gold concourses caught the afternoon sun spectacularly. They are the most beautiful thing for miles. Shuttles and cargo lifters drifted leisurely up and down past the towers and domes like motes of white light. And then it all vanished behind a row of squat warehouses as the taxi moved along. Every few blocks now, there's a ramp descending into the darkness under the streets to underground, the great covered hole in Atlanta. Layers of underpasses and tenements below even more underpasses and tenements built down instead of up. I've never been here before. But you always hear the stories. The stories that respectable people tell each other about that place where the less respectable people live. The taxi pulled up to the curb and stopped. The supervisor's face appeared on the screen again.
Okay, you see that stair ahead of you?
A little arrow blinks, overlaid on the windscreen, showing me where to look. There's a rusted metal sign atop a concrete stairwell. It reads, Thessalonica.
You take that, down level 9. 2169 is a couple blocks north.
I nodded my understanding and tapped my credit sliver against the screen to pay the fare. The taxi door slid open, letting in light, warmth, and a smell like burning rubber. Before I could exit, the supervisor regarded me oddly through his video feed.
You going to be long?
The question took me by surprise.
No, I don't suspect so.
He said, with a tinge of supercilious wisdom, as if he has guessed my motives and finds them disdainful. There are only a few reasons why someone like me would go into underground, so those stories would say. And all of them are shameful and salacious.
Well, if you want my advice, and I think you do, you finish up before dark.
I avoided his televised smirk and stepped out of the taxi.
Yes, all right. Thank you.
The taxi glided away, turning a corner and vanishing out of sight. I fidgeted with the brim of my new canvas hat as I got my bearings. It was instantly hot, like stepping into an oven. Everything here seems bleached by the sun. I could hear the freeway several blocks away with its never-ending stream of traffic. Behind me sat a fuel station, but there was no activity around it, and I couldn't tell if it was open or closed. I was the only visible person for blocks. The effect is eerie. I made for the worn concrete stair and started down the 40 steps between each level. As I went down, the world changed. The smell of burning rubber mingled with the odor of urine and garbage. Litter, mostly beer and liquor bottles, collected in corners. It felt like descending a parking deck, only each level is lined with streets of two- or three-story buildings under haphazard industrial lighting. All the levels are dim and dirty, covered with broken rubble and derelict cars. It was difficult to tell one level from the next. The further down I traveled, the more haze filled the air. I traded my sunglasses for my filter mask to stave off the coughs that began to creep up my throat. By the time I reached Thessalonica 9, a thin pall of smoke hovered over everything. If down level 9 is any indication, life in underground is mostly lived indoors and out of sight. But it spills out onto the streets occasionally with unpredictable and violent abandon. I saw hardly anyone, but there were signs of people and the damage their existence causes. Buildings frequently had broken and boarded up windows. Litter was strewn everywhere. The asphalt was cracked or scorched or stained. I navigated around a burned-out shell of a car that blocks the sidewalk. An array of power cables, spliced amateurishly into the mains, sprawled carelessly from a hole in the ceiling, sending tendrils of wire off in all directions to vanish into windows, over fences, and down alleys. I did see a few people as I walked along. A boy on a skateboard rolled past me, staring but otherwise leaving me alone. A couple of prostitutes walked on the other side of the street, taking turns with an oxygen mask. How could people live down here? But of course, there is nowhere else. No room left on the crowded continents for those with little means. The address I wanted was an old hotel, now graffiti-marked and grimy. Perhaps it had been a nice place once, but no longer. I hurried inside and moved through the gutted, dingy lobby and into the hallways, searching for apartment 15A. As I passed each door, I could sense the presence of life behind them. Light shining under a door here, or the blare of a television there. Behind one door, people were either arguing or having sex. But the derelict desolation of this grimy hallway, with its tattered carpeting and peeling wallpaper, belied the very real presence of unseen, unknown people behind these doors, hidden from the sun. The numbers on the door, when present, told me I was going in the right direction, but something caught my eye. In the middle of the hallway, on the floor, a discarded overcoat moved. But it wasn't an overcoat. It was a man. A skeleton swimming in his old, stained clothes, wrinkled and aged, his skin parchment white and marked with bruises and oozing cuts. The man turned his head toward the sound of my approach, but his eyes were cloudy and he didn't seem to see me. His greasy white hair had fallen out in patches, and his skin was marked with knobby scabs. This sick and ancient man reached out a hand in my direction and I froze. His lips pulled apart into a horrible groan, wet and gurgling. And then his hand fell back onto his chest and he just lay there, wheezing. Don't get involved, of course, is the first instinct. It's someone else's problem. It's a survival instinct from living in the metro. But I stopped and I checked the hallway anyway. There was no one else. No sign of which room this man might belong to. I certainly was not equipped to help him personally. I could call the police, but everyone says the police only come to Underground if they must. Would they bother? I thought of the tattooed man who saved me at the train station. He could have abandoned me to the trampling crowd. And then I thought of how the man looked. How pale. How lost. His arms and neck marked with lesions. He reminded me of Ken Zinn. And perhaps of me. I took my earpiece from my pocket and dialed emergency services on my tablet.
Emergency services, what do you need?
There's a man here. He's very sick. I think he needs medical attention.
My filter mask muffled my voice, but the operator understands me.
What is the nature of his injuries?
I don't know. He's just very sick. He's on the floor. He seems weak and is having a hard time breathing. Could you send someone? An ambulance or something?
Where are you?
I gave her the address and added,
he's in the hallways near apartment 11A.
And your name?
I hesitated, but then I just hung up. Fears and doubts again. Would I get in trouble? They don't need my name anyway. The medics would come and take care of the man, and if they didn't, well, at least I did something. The truth is I was afraid to stay. So, I left the man behind. Apartment 15A was at the end of the corridor around the corner. I rang the bell. No sense in second thoughts at this point. There was a long pause, and then a woman's voice, sharp and anxious, called out through the grill of the speaker near the door.
What do you want?
I figured that if there's a speaker, there's also a camera. So I took off my filter mask so she could see my face.
Is this Mrs. Zinn? Mrs. Sook Zinn? What do you want?
I'm sorry to bother you, but my name is Christopher Cousins, Dr. Cousins from the university. I wondered if I could talk to you. Mrs. Zinn?
The many locks on the door unlatched with a series of rattles and clicks. The door opened a scant inch, and a small woman puts her eye to the space created, looking at me, then past me, and around me. Then she opened it a little wider.
Come in.
Her home smelled of cigarette smoke and cooking cabbage. It was a tiny place, smaller than mine. The kitchen area by the front door had just enough room for one person to stand in. A pot steamed on the stove. A bar separated the kitchen from the simple living area, furnished with a low table, cushions on the floor, and a rolled-up futon in the corner. There was a television set into one wall, switched off. Mounted opposite it is a cloth wall hanging embroidered with the image of the Buddha. Below this, a small brass incense burner and a potted orchid, certainly artificial, it must be, were placed carefully on a tiny shelf. The single window offered a view of nothing more than another concrete wall 6 inches away outside. Mrs. Zinn finished the long process of relocking her door.
Please,
she said, gesturing to the living area.
Sit down. Would you like tea?
Yes, thank you, if it's not too much trouble. Mrs. Zinn silently moved into the cramped kitchen and reached into the tight cupboards, getting out the implements for a pot of tea. I settled onto one of the cushions on the floor. As Mrs. Zinn filled the teapot with water and set it on the stove, I took another look at the little shrine. The orchid's cream-colored petals were moist, and I could smell its scent, a sweet perfume. Astonishingly, it was real. Discreetly hanging above it, placed just so, was a small mirror, reflecting the sunlight from somewhere. I followed the angle of the mirror to find another one placed by the window. This one pointed outside the glass to a third, which is, in turn, pointed upward toward the sky.
There is a gap.
She was putting on a few prepackaged cookies on a plate.
The sun shines down for 3 hours, more in summer. And you set this up to capture it. Ingenious. Tried growing orchids with artificial light. But they grow sick and die. Very hard to grow anything down here.
She poured hot water into a plain ceramic teapot, her lined, tight face briefly obscured by steam.
Yes,
is all I could think to say. It must be hard to grow something healthy and beautiful amid the decay I saw on my way here. But that feels true everywhere. Not merely in the underground. The uncomfortable silence stretched. I decided to broach the difficult truth of why I came.
Mrs. Zinn, I don't know if they told you, but I was the teacher who...
She emerged from the kitchen carrying a tray with the tea, her face locked in an unreadable mask, hard around the edges, lips pursed in a non-smile.
Yes, Dr. Cousins. I know who you are.
She set down the tray on the table, knelt upon a cushion, began to pour.
I am sorry. Only powdered tea.
I felt for her.
If it was difficult for me to speak about these things, it must have been so much harder for her. How is it that the most important facets of our lives are the hardest for us to talk about? I studied her face to try to discover what she was feeling or thinking. Her dark brown hair was pulled into a practical bun. Something about her reminded me a little of the statue at All Saints Station. Something once pretty but now worn away, making her look older than she was. Her hands looked especially rough, dry and calloused, knuckles swollen as she held the teapot. The rest of her was hard and eroded, like a mountain. Her eyes quick and intelligent. She was hiding her emotions well. She filled my cup, and I reached for it.
"I have no money,"
she said, topping off her own cup and setting the teapot on the tray. I stared at her, uncomprehending.
"I'm sorry, what? There is no money for compensation."
There was a hint of desperation in her voice, behind the control she's trying to exert. I brought my cup down to my lap.
"No, no, Mrs. Zinn. I didn't come here about compensation."
She flicked her eyes up from her teacup to my face, trying to discover my intentions.
"I promise. I don't want your money."
She seemed to accept that, nodding once, and sipping her tea. A thoughtful silence returned between us, and I sipped mine as well. It was hot and bitter. At length, with her eyes downcast, she said to me very softly,
"What my son did to you was a terrible thing. I am sorry. Thank you. But I didn't come here for an apology either." "Why did you come?"
I'm still trying to figure that out myself, to be honest. Ever since it happened, I've not been able to shake that day. And I don't mean the violence itself. I mean that it happened at all. The circumstances. The reasons why I hadn't spoken these things aloud. I didn't have anyone to say them to until now.
"I didn't know your son. I don't know any of my students, not very well. The way the university works these days, it's just not easy to take an interest. I know that's a poor excuse, but it's the only one I have. Everything that happened that day, it makes no sense. I need it to make sense. Would you like to see his room?"
We rose. There's a curtain covering a doorway, and she pulled it back and touched a pad on the wall. Stark white light flicked on from a fixture overhead, illuminating a closet-sized room. It was shocking, frightening, even. Swirls of black and white paint completely covered every inch of the walls and ceiling. Rough, jagged lines and huge spirals intermingled with words written in different languages. English, some Spanish, Korean, I think. Crude images of people were painted amid the storm of lines and curves, crawling, skulking, hovering. The patterns sprawled and dripped, not made by a talented hand, but driven by a feverish need, madness seeking expression. The floor was only just large enough to hold an unrolled futon, its sheets in disarray. On the floor next to it was an electronic tablet and its docking station, along with a pair of expensive audio headphones plugged in. A footlocker sat open, a jumble of clothes scattered inside.
"The police have already been here,"
said Mrs. Zinn, looking into the room with a soft, sad expression.
"They took some things. They say my son was depressed. They say many are like him, and they all want to die."
Her brows tighten. Why do they want to die?
I read some of the phrases on the wall, at least the ones I can understand. On the ceiling, directly over the bed, was written, "They don't see," in large, shaky letters. Under that was a infinity symbol, a figure eight on its side. There were snippets of other words, like phrases from fever dream poetry. If death is a part of life, then even death must die. Blind, alone, but not alone. Miserable phrases scrawled in miserable print.
You didn't know he was depressed?
She stiffened at the question, though I didn't intend to insult her.
I work two jobs. I work at Krill Factory during day, then overnight at Gateport cargo loading. Ken's father, not here, just us.
She then looked away, out of the room, eyes glowing with renewed grief.
Just me. I'm sorry.
I looked down at the disheveled sheets on the futon. There were spatters of black and white paint on them, probably from the hours he spent painting his madness onto the walls. How long had he been on this slow slide toward despair?
I knew he was sad. I knew he was going out a lot. But I did not know where. I thought it better he with friends than sitting alone in his room all day. He used to do that. He would listen to music and paint on the wall and not say anything. He got angry if I come in, try to talk to him. So I thought it good that he go out with friends. But now I do not think he had friends. No one called for him. No one asked about him. Where did he go? Who did he talk to? I had to work.
I noticed a section of the wall that stands out from the rest, as if Ken Zen gave it much more effort. I took a half step into the room to get a better look. He had painted a deep, dark spiral on the wall, black and white mixing to form stormy grays. Hiding within the spiral, something lurked there, an abstract shape, beast-like and strange, edges blurred, making it hard to tell where it ended and the spiral began. Underneath, he had printed something in black paint with his fingertip. Lo and behold, they come. They drum their names. The angels of death are indifferent. As it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be. World without end, end without world. My skin crawled, but not from these dreadful words alone. Ken Zen expressed his depression by surrounding himself in it, concentrating it, living within it as it lived within him. And I thought of my own little room, with its own particular concentrations, the stuff of my life. What would it take to push me to this point? To hurry me along to here. Bunched up next to the futon, I spied a pile of used gauze, streaked with dried blood. Lesions, perhaps.
Your son was, he looked thin. Was he sick?
Her fingers fidgeted against each other.
I leave him food. Sometimes he eat, but many times not.
But then she nodded, as if only now reaching a decision or being willing to express it.
I think he was sick. I see many people around here like him. They don't eat. They get thin. They live for a long time this way. They just hang on. Couldn't the doctors do anything? I cannot afford a doctor. The clinic not do anything. Just tell him to eat more. Besides, sometimes people who get sick like that, they go to the hospital, and they not come back. You mean they die? No. They not come back.
Her lips tightened as if she'd said too much, fear making her mute. So I didn't press her. I took another look around the room. I didn't see anything here that ties me to him. But the more I thought of it, the more I am sure that he did not intend to shoot me at all.
He never talked to you about school? Toward the end, we almost never talk. But he never talked about you, Dr. Cousins. But I tell you what I think. I think my son was so sad. I think my son felt so alone. He wanted company in his death. But I do not think he wanted you in particular. He just wanted someone with him. And you were there. That is what I think. You need it to make sense? I need it to make sense too. But I cannot make any more sense of it than that. I'm sorry.
She left her son's doorway and returned to the tiny kitchen to busy herself with the pot on the stove. I took a last look at Ken Zinn's room before turning off the light and drawing the curtain, hiding away the concentrated despair behind that thin sheet of fabric. She was ladling soup with boiled cabbage into a container, her posture rigid.
I must go to work soon, Dr. Cousins. I am off from my first job today, but they need me for overtime tonight at the gateport. Yes, of course. I'll see myself out.
As I opened the locks, I tried to think of something to say to her. Something significant or meaningful. I would even settle for compassionate. The best thing I could come up with were her own words.
What happened to your son was a terrible thing. I'm sorry.
I opened the door.
Thank you for the tea.
Mrs. Zinn didn't reply, methodically ladling out her soup. I noticed the orchid across the room and how the light shining on it had faded. Evening was approaching, and soon it would be rush hour and dark after that. And so I left. The hallway seemed darker and grimier than before. I hadn't gone far when I heard Mrs. Zinn engaging the locks on her door. Somewhere overhead, a plane roared toward the gateport, the force of its engines vibrating the building and sending trails of dust down from the ceiling. The old man in the hallway was gone without a trace.
An Invisible Sun is written, produced, performed, and composed by W. Keith Timms, and is a production of Alien Ghost Robot Creative Media. If you're enjoying the story, please tell your friends and family about it, and leave stars or reviews on your favorite podcast platforms. I hope you'll join us on our Discord server, or sign up for our mailing list so we can stay in touch. Members of our Patreon get to hear future episodes early, plus other cool perks for all our shows. Go to InvisibleSunPod.com for more information.